everyone, and welcome to episode 123 of season 11 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. For today's interview episode, I am very pleased to bring you my conversation with Ross McCall, who plays Joe Liebgott in the series. So, Ross, thank you very much for joining me.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward. We there's a lot to talk about when you talk about Liebgott.
Yes, indeed. Liebgott, a big part of my life. 25 years later, still.
That's right. All right. So, why don't you tell me and everyone else how did you get the part? Do you remember the process?
Yeah, of course. The audition process was pretty worldwide. So all your main hubs, LA, New York, Chicago, London, I think Sydney, Australia at one point as well, they started casting the net out. Every actor of our generation knew about it. They knew the big boys were coming to town, Spielberg and Hanks. I think we were all just irritating our agents at that point, saying, get me in. And we were told to remain calm, and all good things come to those who wait.
And there's a lot of parts.
Yeah, there was a lot of parts. Yeah, and you know, I mean, that was the whole thing. They shot the majority of the show in the UK and Switzerland, and so I think the initial thought was the 10 main guys were definitely, probably going to be more American actors getting attached, and UK actors would play the bulk of the rest of the roles. And that just changed kind of during the audition process. And two or three of us slipped through that net and were kind of brought in to play one of those 10 main guys. So I was really lucky in the sense that Liebgott was a character that was well written about in the book by Dr. Ambrose, and well talked about amongst the men. And very early on, I kind of got a sniff that that's where I would be leaning towards. One of my first, a lot of people auditioned 10 times and didn't get the role. And there were people who auditioned 7 times and did. I got very lucky. I had 3 auditions. My first one was with Meg Lieberman and Angela Terry, two very well-renowned casting directors in America. And it was in the Royal Athenaeum Hotel in London. I went and I met them, got through that first wave. And then I was asked by Meg to come back the following week to sit down with Tom Hanks. And I told them I would have to check my schedule.
Yeah, clearly. Who's that? Why would you want to spend time with that guy?
And Tom was literally at the end of Castaway, you know, so he had the beard and he had his bandana on, lost a lot of weight. And he could not have been kinder or more generous to a young actor who, you know, of course, is Tom Hanks. And so I ended up reading with Tom, and I was already a winner in my eyes. You know, walking out of that room, I was 10 foot high. I just worked with Tom Hanks. You know, I just read a scene with him.
Was it a scene with Liebgott as Liebgott, or was it a random scene?
No, everybody was given the same set of sides to begin with. So what they did was they really just had like little bits, because the full show wasn't written. I mean, you know,
right,
phones were, but things were still getting massaged in. And so everyone had, I forget which speech, but there was a particular speech that everybody was sort of given to drill home. But they did have in the audition, they had a board with 10 of the guys and their faces. And there was a point where I kind of looked over and I saw a picture of Liebgott, and I felt that my nod was going that way. I was a slender kid anyway at 24, you know, I was a slender build, but I knew I had to drop weight to play Lieb, because he was between 120, 130 pounds. And I got down to about 135 with an excellent Hollywood diet of push-ups and cigarettes, which I wouldn't recommend to anyone now, but it was a different time back then. So I really wanted to
get into the character, and Liebgott smokes a lot, so it makes sense.
Right. Sure. But I also knew how drawn he was, and he was a slender guy with a temper, you know. I knew I had to kind of match that. that template. So I knew early on I was probably leaning towards him. And then my third and final audition was with the executive producers, you know. And pretty shortly after that, I got the nod saying, "Yeah, you're going to boot camp, kid, and get ready. And here you go, your life's about to change." And we went and did a 10-day boot camp.
What did they tell you about the boot camp beforehand? I mean, did they accurately describe it to you, or did you get there and you're like, "What the hell? this isn't what was in my contract."
A bit of both. You know, we had a letter from Captain Dye. I often say this whenever I talk about Banner Brothers. Banner Brothers is there's a lot of people involved to make that show the success it was. But there were five at the top, and that would be Tom and Steven, Meg Liebman, who cast it, Tony Toe, who was one of our executive producers, who was the on the ground producer when Tony and Steven wasn't there, and Captain Dye, who put us through boot camp
right.
with him and his cousin. So we were aware of it. Captain Dye had sent everybody a hand-typed letter to their homes, dated in the 40s, you know, welcoming you to an adventure. And there were various things within this letter that led you to believe this was going to be a full-on boot camp that was going to be in line with how these men trained. But it still didn't prepare us. No,
right.
We landed in boot camp, and I think safe to say all of us were kind of like, "All right, this is there's no way anyone's calling their agents at this point." You know, everyone got a little battered, a little bruised, but nobody bailed. The physicality of it was brutal. I daren't ever insult any you know, military members that I run into. It's nowhere close to their basic training, but it was as close as it possibly could be without being in regular basic. They beat the snot out of us.
Okay,
you know, but
that's what they wanted you to feel like the men of Easy.
Absolutely, but also what it did was it really, first of all, it bonded us, it gave us a real trauma bond.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden, the guys, we were like this. But more importantly, what it allowed us to do is allow the cameras to keep rolling. And a director would never have to say cut because some actor's putting their hand up saying, "Oh, I, you know, my weapon's jammed." We knew how to get out of them.
Right.
You know, we knew how to get out of the weapon jam. We knew how to throw a grenade. We knew how to march. We knew how to rumble. We knew how to run. We knew how to, you know, we knew how to hold ourselves in these in the same way as these men did, and so that was the genius of boot camp, in my opinion.
Yeah. Now I spoke a few months ago with Freddie Joe, and he told me that he had a lot of fun kicking all your butts. So yeah.
Freddie is a pussycat, and that's why I love him, because he was one of the first people I met at boot camp, and he was my sergeant, so he was the one running our platoon. You know, Captain dies at the top,
yeah,
and he oversaw everybody, and then we had all these different cadre members taking care of different platoons, and I was second platoon, and Freddie was the first person to yell in my face, I think, ever outside of a bar. You know,
and did he scare you the way that he was yelling at you at first? Yeah, you know, at the initial meeting, you know.
Yeah, I think scare is the wrong word, because we knew what we were getting into. I think it was like there was an apprehension, perhaps, of, okay, how serious is this?
Right.
But what I will say about Freddie, who's one of my dearest friends, is he is as brutal as he is with the yapping.
Mm-hmm.
He has a heart the size of Texas.
Yes.
And he would look after his men, and he did in such great ways when we were battered and bruised, and when we were hitting walls, and when we were getting moments of like real sleep deprivation or exhaustion or whatever it was, whatever wall we were hitting, he was the one that would secretly be able to take you to one side, have a quick chat with you, you know, load you up on cigarettes or whatever contraband he'd managed to get his hands on. And he, I've got a lot of love for that guy.
Wow, that's great. And I mean, were there guys, and again, I'm not asking for names, but were there guys who didn't take it as seriously and, you know, kept getting punished until they realized okay, maybe I need to take this a little more serious, or they're going to kick me off.
Not one.
No, okay,
Not one.
that's great.
Not one person didn't see the end goal. And I think that's what was important. Listen, Tom and Stephen came down to boot camp day one and gave us a big rousing speech, a very patriotic, passionate speech about this is going to be tough. Get through it. You're all used to movie sets and people making you tea and your car picking you up in the morning and perhaps people fawning over you. This is a different vibe. So not one of us spent longer than 30 minutes in our trailers during a year of shooting.
Wow.
We would all be together. We would all we'd all get our kit on in the morning together. We would all goof around together. We'd play sports together. We would socialize together. And all of that was from boot camp because everybody took it seriously. And in fact, if there was some that perhaps internally were fighting that, it never came out because everybody was just on this path.
Right.
We have a story to tell. We have a legacy to uphold, and we have to honor these men.
Right. And you also all knew that there's at least 100 other guys that will take your place if you don't take it seriously.
Sure, but I feel even more than that was the casting program was so advanced, and they knew exactly what they were doing. Not only were they casting actors that they thought could portray these men, they were casting men that they had an inkling, I don't know how, that they were going to take this, with the utmost sincere respect,
mm-hmm.
and they knew that. And so that's why I steal from somebody else. But Frank says this often, Meg cast our best friends.
Right.
She introduced us to our best friends. 25 years later, we're still having phone calls and text messages every day, So it's, to a man, everybody understood what the project was.
Yeah, no, that's just amazing. I mean, I've heard so many stories from so many people on the production, even the actors. And again, you're resonating everything that they've said. I mean, this is, and it's such a unique thing because it's not something that normally has happened in any other, in just about, I've never heard of another production where 25 years later, people are still, getting texts, and happy to get
it was,
them.
It was lightning in a bottle. And look, other shows have come since that were very close to it. Brilliant shows, wonderful, creative, talent-driven shows. They didn't have that lightning in a bottle that Band had. We're not sure why, but we think it's because of the bond of the real men, and because of that bond of the real men was so solidified early on in the book. By Ambrose, in the scripts that we read, in the directors we were working with, in the producers we were working with. I mean, this was Tom's baby,
right.
And he was more passionate than anybody. And so to see that filter down, it just made it a successful mission in a sense. People have asked me over the years, did you think Band would ever become as big as it became? And there's some guys that say, no, I knew. But don't ask me how. I knew it was going to be an absolute game changer in the sense of, it's still entertainment, right?
Correct.
I mean, there's some Hollywood liberties within the show, which you have to do, because if you were going to do that book play by play, it's 100 episodes.
Right.
Now, you and I may watch that, but
that's right.
not the public may not. No. And so you have to find this. And so just seeing it all come together, I knew it was going to be this incredible feat of storytelling that still holds up. I mean, you watch
completely.
It now, it looks like
there's no question about that. That now watching it is more emotional because now you see the men that were still around 25 years ago and now they're not.
Yes.
That's the added thing that time has given us about the.
Well, and on that point, when you were even saying that. There are people that perhaps don't feel the need to talk about a show that they did 25 years ago. And I can understand that.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we're all actors, we're all makers. We've all gone on and done 1,000 other TV shows. We've all done 1,000 other movies. We've all got careers, and there's things that we are very proud of.
Mm-hmm.
There's not much that I go back and talk about 25 years later. But I think what Ben did, and especially because the men are no longer with us, there was just an unwritten promise, I guess, of all right, then we'll hold that legacy for you. We'll keep that legacy alive as long as we can. And we're no fools. We know we're actors. You know, we're not these men, but we are a portrayal of them that some people kind of connect to. And because the show still looks like you watch any show from the 2000s, they look dated.
Yes.
You know, look at band, and apart from fans of ours now who now know what we look like now, that's the only thing that gives us away. You sit down and you watch a show because it just looks like it was shot last year, the way that they saturated that film stock
That's right.
and the way they put it. So, you know, we just know that that legacy of the men was something that our unwritten promise is to just uphold that.
Right. When they told you that you're being cast as Joe Liebgott, I know that Joe himself passed away before the show. Did you get in touch with his family? Did you talk with some of the other men maybe about him or something to that effect?
Okay, so when everybody was cast and boot camp was upon us, and we were doing all the things you have to do, the wardrobe fitting and the table reads and whatnot, your research starts. You know, acting is more than hitting your mark and learning your lines. You know, I mean, there's a lot of research that goes into it. There's a lot of homework that goes into it. I say this often. You know, I'm a Scottish Catholic who sounds English, playing in an American Jew who speaks German.
Well,
Right.
not really, but yeah.
And so
Because
I'm trying. Well,
we'll
I
get to
mean,
that. We'll get to that.
that's also to be debated. That's also to be debated. There's no proof either side fully on that. So we.
Okay. I can't prove it, but I've
Right. And so, you know, I've been told certain things, you've read certain things. We can find a medium ground. Anyway, it's a
No,
different
I'd
story.
love to. That's fine.
But no, to answer the question, I did not have any contact with the family. Bear in mind, this is pre-internet, you know, so the search is different. Everybody was given like a dossier, and there were people whose characters were very well, the men were very well spoken about in the book, but perhaps didn't make it to the screen as much as they were in the book. But even they had like files upon files of letters and contact numbers and family members and pictures and all these things. And I got given a manila envelope with one picture. It was a Xerox picture of the same picture of Liebgott in the book. And I was like, oh boy, you know, where do I go with this? And I was doing my own research on the other side of things anyway. But to your point, I very quickly realized these men very rarely talked about themselves, but they would talk about their
That's right.
friends. And so I could lean into Wild Bill. I could speak to Babe. I could speak to Mr. Compton. I could speak to Major Winters and ask questions. And they were open books, and they would talk about their friends, and they would give me such great insight that was just immeasurable for an actor. So actually, you know, benefited me in many ways.
Okay, so let's talk about that elephant in the room. What's your information about Liebgott's religion?
So, you know, look, and again, I go in, I've read many books, I've spoken to people since that say he was Catholic, he wasn't Jewish. From my telling and from the intel that we were getting early on, he was. And again, unless I'm speaking to maybe one or two people, I don't have an answer for that. I have heard it over the years that he wasn't Jewish, and some of the company men just thought he was Jewish because of his hatred towards the
That's right.
Germans, which I find that a hard tale. I find that a hard conversation to have. Again, I'm not there, so you know, I really don't want to defend either side
No,
of it.
completely. And
Or
you've even opened my eyes now to it because everyone that I've spoken to about this issue, whether it was some of the writers or producers or historians, they've all told me, matter of fact, that he was not a Jew and that they just assumed that he was and whatever. But then, as you said, it always raised the question with me about, okay, so where was this hatred from? A and B, he had the language skills, so
Sure,
those
sure.
two things are you know, make you wonder about whatever it is, you know.
And again, that's where I lay with it. And truthfully, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day, in the sense of the storytelling technique of what the show was. There were many instances with certain characters that afterwards historians came out and said, well, did this really happen with this guy? And was this guy real? And was this, but, and I think what it was, there was a collection of, again, you can't do 100 episodes. No. So there was three different guys that would sort of mold into one to tell that story. Mm-hmm. And much like, yes, this show is about Easy Company, they're also telling the story of the military. Yeah. They're telling the story of many men from around the world. And so to me, you have to take it bit by bit, and storytelling to have Liebgott have a Jewish faith and be presented with the situations he was presented with is epic storytelling.
Oh, for sure. I've always loved the little quote unquote hat tips along the way. I mean, even in the first episode, when they're in Tekoa, Phil will come over to Liebgott and make a comment about the fact, how are you going to kill Nazis, you know, if your bayonet is rusty or whatever it is. And you can tell the undertone. And again, this is in the way the story is being told, this is a Jew saying to another Jew, you know, let's, you know, we want to go kill Nazis. How are you going to do it if you have a, you know, a rusty bayonet, you know, that type of thing. And then obviously the fight on the transport ship, and you know, it continues throughout. So, you know, I'm actually glad that you've brought that up, because up until this point, based on the conversations I've had and the research I've had, it's been clear cut, and I'm glad to see that it's not clear cut, because that adds more to the authenticity of the way that the show depicted things. Even though, again, I know it's not 100% true. We all know that. You know, we're watching, as you said, we're watching entertainment. You know, we're watching them take this story of the men of Easy Company, show it to the world, tell us the type of things that these men went through, and you know, with right. The interviews, we see what they went through. Also, you know, 50 years later, and that type of thing. So it's an amazing way to tell this story. And you know, to when you find, I guess mistakes is probably the wrong word to use, but when you find inconsistencies along the way, it makes you start saying, oh well, okay, you know, I don't know. But nothing's perfect. I don't think there's a single movie or TV show or anything that is based on something that happened that is 100% truth. And when you watch it and you take that into consideration, you know.
And all I can say is if for the time when the show was up and running, and look, I mean, it's stated in Dr. Ambrose's book as a fact, you know, that that's what he was told.
Yes, that's right. He was told that because as you said, right. That's what they assumed. You know, again, right. It could be and that so, they were right. It could be there. I think it says in there that I think it was Shames made a comment about the fact that he never saw him come to any service. Okay, but that doesn't mean anything either.
Sure.
You know, that's a sort of proof, but not 100% proof.
I think to the best of their knowledge at that time, with the knowledge that they had and the information that they had, that was absolutely where they went with it. You know, mm-hmm. that was and his name kind of made
of course.
Sense. That and the fact that I think a grandmother of his was perhaps German, and you know, they had the information at the time that was right. Correct for them.
Again, that's great. And obviously, thinking that he's not a Jew makes all the scenes in Landsberg feel cheaper. But knowing that, but thinking that he is, strengthens it even more so. I mean, I'm sure you've heard this before, but I must commend you on the way that you dealt with that scene where you needed to, you know, tell all the prisoners to go back in, and you just see that, you know, you just break down. And
but that's also fantastic writing from John Orloff, you know, and getting that and David Frankel directing
it. You can give everyone as much credit as you want, but you're the one portraying it, and you're the one who showed it to us. Okay, I you know, that's fine that it was written. So it says one of two things. It says either you know how to follow instructions really well, or you went a little beyond. So either way, I think that that was great.
I'm not sure about the first thing, but maybe.
You're the actor, I'm not.
No, absolutely. Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's some other scenes also, but that one is, the,
Of course.
because it's you're just sitting there silently, and the look on your face is just wow. It says so much. Okay, so let's back up a little bit. Let's go back. So you're spending 10 months filming this series. You appear in 9 out of 10 of the parts. What did you do when they were filming episode 4? I know it was all
So
simultaneous.
I'm
I know it
at
was simultaneously, but yeah.
well so I was supposed to be in episode 4 as well. And in fact, I think there's only like five characters that are in all 10, and Leap one of them. And when we were shooting 4, Tom was shooting 5, and I had quite a lot of moments in Tom's episode.
Well, that's
I
the
had
one with
quite a few
the
scenes with
one
Tom.
bullet. That's the one bullet
That's
episode.
right. That's right. And it's in the dike, and there's a lot of stuff going on there. And then Ali gets injured at one point, and we have, it's a crossroads. It's a
Of
big
course.
deal. And Tom, quite rightly, needed his guys. And so there were times where they're like, we need to get Liebgard in a Jeep and get him over to Eindhoven for episode 4. And the boss would say, nope, need him here at the crossroads. So that's basically what happened. So 4, I think I was supposed to be in with a darts game or doing something. It would have been a small episode for Liebgard, but I was kept with the boss at that point, and I was happy to be
Okay,
so.
did they at least not take away from your pay because in the end you were in 9 instead of 10?
It worked out
Okay,
fine.
good. I'm glad. I'm glad. Hey, come on, as a young actor, that's also part of
Yeah,
it.
sure. Sure.
You would have fought more if they would have said we're going to be docking your pay because of that. Oh, wait, but it's your decision, not mine.
You would absolutely fight it. No, but it was all above board and taken care
Yeah,
of.
no, I'm sure. I'm aware that that's all in jest, as you know. Right. So here you are. You're filming all these scenes. One of the things that I've also heard that is quite unique is that a lot of times when the characters aren't necessarily in the foreground, they made sure that you guys were all in the background somewhere in order to show, okay, Liebgat might not be in this scene, but you can see him in the back. He's doing something
Absolutely.
else and stuff like
It
that.
was a unit. It was absolutely the unit of Easy Company. And again, that's where boot camp comes into play. So if you're not in a featured scene where your man is heavily featured, yeah, at some point, and everyone, this happened to everybody, you'd be lurking around in the background, but you'd be doing something, you'd be keeping busy, you would be keeping it real, and all of that was boot camp. Captain Die would be like, get in the back, do this, blah, blah, blah. Okay, got it. So we knew what we were doing, and we knew how to soldier. And part of that was, okay, if the lens is there and there's a scene focused on these two guys and seven of us are back here, then we know what we're doing. And then, of course, it comes to our scene, and it's me and another guy, and seven people behind me. They know what they're doing. Yeah, it was all good.
Exactly. Wow, that's great. Okay, so you've gone through the 10 months of shooting. You're pretty much done, and they say, all right, we're gonna have you come back for a little party in Normandy. What was
Yeah,
that like?
they Well, we knew that we were gonna premiere in Normandy. We knew they were gonna build a theater on the beach, or just off the beach, which sounded like an incredible infrastructure that they were gonna assemble and disassemble, not disassemble, I should say. And they were like, "All right, we're flying you to Paris." So we all went to Paris, and we went there with a lot of vets, their families. We all went with our girlfriends, significant others, wives. And we gave them a promise of, hey, we're going to have, you know, a great week in Paris before we go to the premiere. And of course, everybody was like, sign me up. And as soon as we walked into the hotel, and we're all jet lagged, we go to the hotel bar, which is where our vets were sitting waiting on us, getting ready to toast the show. And there we stayed for the next 5 days. And so our significant others didn't get to see the glory of Paris in the way that we'd promised. But I think each of them all realized what we were involved with and how special it was. And nobody really missed the trip up the Seine, you know. Everybody was there having stories being told, and just a huge family unit, and it was incredible. And then we all went up to Normandy. All the dignitaries were there. There was veterans from all over brought in, and some of our guys, it was the first time they'd seen the show. Some not, some had already seen some of it, but gauging their reactions, it was incredible being able to watch the premiere and watch
Right.
them and watch the men and see how they reacted. And some were just full of pride, some were full of emotion, some were scarred in a therapeutic way, you know, being able to open up and talk about it. And to our point earlier, the only thumbs up we needed was from the
Correct.
men. And when we got that, and we got the, you did it. That's it. That's all we need. Close the book.
Makes sense.
And listen, the show went on, and all the Golden Globes and all the Emmys and all the beautiful awards and accolades and press and historians, you know, picking apart little bits here and there, whatever that is, then turn around and said, you did it. That's it. That's all we need.
Wow. That's just amazing. The way that I mean, again, that it's what makes it so unique.
Yes. Yeah.
And so you said
Yeah.
some of the people had seen the episodes before. You had seen the episodes before you were in Normandy?
I think some people had glanced at some. I'd certainly seen some cut episodes, yeah, way before the premiere. They would very secretly hand off to a few of us. Hey, check out this episode, check out this episode. And so, you know, we were
Oh,
getting
wow.
little glances of it. I remember being in my house kind of nervously and excitedly sitting down with a VHS tape and popping that in and watching it and going, holy woof,
Wow.
boy, we got seven. So yeah, I mean, I was wet. And of course, you know, the episode they chose to show for the premiere is the D-Day landings, you know, so it's episode
Right.
two.
Yeah, I heard
But they
they
also
showed like
did.
a quick reel of the first episode and the full second episode. But that's also the second episode is also the shortest out of all the 10 episodes. So that might have been part of
That's right.
the decision also, to do it that way.
Well, and also, I think it's a big
Oh, for
campaign at
sure.
that point, Port Manor. But also, they did a whole melody of the rest of the show after it. So you had a little bit of episode one, all of episode two, had like a reel of, you know, episodes three, like a extended
Right.
trailer. And those were, you know, we did Normandy premiere, and then we
I
did the
live home.
Hollywood Bowl in Los Angeles. And then we did New Orleans. So those were the three premieres that we
Oh,
did.
wow. All right, and then
Yeah.
a few months later, it starts showing. And so, how did you watch the shows when they were coming out? I mean, I know it was around 9/11, so it was a very trying time after the first two premieres, basically. The showing episodes one and two. But did you gather with friends? Did you gather with the other men to sit and watch the
Yeah,
shows? And
we all got together in Los Angeles. So
You were
we
living in
knew
LA
that
at the time?
I was over in LA at this point. I wasn't living here full time, but I was over here for the show. So I was over for the premiere and some press we had to do and all kinds of stuff. So yeah, and we premiered the week before 9/11. And then of course the world changed, and there was talk of how do you proceed with this show right now? Do we pull it? Do we hold off? Do we whatever? And public reaction was so strong. It was like everybody needed something to feel patriotic about and to remind ourselves perhaps of what this great generation did for the world. Somebody somewhere made that decision to continue, and it skyrocketed. People needed it. People wanted the show, needed it. And I think it was around that time. I remember seeing something in, it was one of the big tabloids, maybe New York Times or something. And I remember opening up there, you know, and it was a double pager, and it had all the first responders. And it said Band of Brothers above all the first responders.
Wow.
And I remember it was set out like the poster of the show. And I remember just seeing that and, you know, felt very emotional and was like, okay, this people need this right now. And it proved right, you know. So yeah, we all got together and we all hung out in various different folks' place each Sunday. And we would sit down and we would watch an episode. And, you know, it was a joyous affair once it was up and running, and once we started to find a balance in the world and all of that, you know.
Right. Wow, that's just amazing. You know, and again, you're still connected with all these guys 25 years later. Do you guys have Band of Brother watches every so often?
No, I think we all, I mean, I hadn't seen the show in many years. You know, I hadn't seen it for a good 15 or so years. And then it was highlighted to me. And I said, you know what, I should sit down and watch this as an audience member, mm-hmm. you know, have it move forward with all of us and in our own careers. And, you know, we were on different shows at this point, and we had a different outlook, and we're playing different characters and whatnot. And to go back and revisit the show as an audience member and not as one of the guys going, okay, let's, you know, I remember this. It was fascinating and wonderful. And you know, I've seen it a few times over the years now, and we're all different actors. Yeah. We would all play it very differently now just because of life and maturity and all that. But you watch it, and I wouldn't change a thing. I would not change a thing from any of the guys. I think everybody knocks it out of park. I think the performances are just so beautiful.
I completely agree with you. I wouldn't either. You know, obviously I'm not looking at it from the perspective of an actor. But I'm just saying this is one of the most perfect miniseries ever made from the perspective that, you know, over the course of these 10 episodes, you watch it and you're like, I know these guys. You know, yeah. I'm familiar with these guys. Oh, my God, I can't believe Garnier got hit. You know, it's like things like that. They were connected with the men.
You know, it's an incredible sort of thing to witness, because you do, you get to know and love the mm-hmm. guys. And you follow. And so, of course, anything that happens to them or their friends or whatever is heartbreaking. And you're with them. You're with the men of Easy. That's the power of the show.
The only, I guess, issue that I always have with the show is the epilogue, from the perspective that they only tell us about the guys who are still there at the very end. Like, you know, someone like Garnier, someone like Joe Toy, they don't tell us anything about them. I mean, again, I understand the decision, but as someone who enjoys, you know, watching it and is moved by listening to the stories of what happened to these quote unquote ordinary guys who went back to ordinary lives afterwards. You know, I mean, again, the epilogue about Liebgott is Liebgott went back and, you know, became a cab driver again. That's pretty much all they say. You know, not much beyond that. And you know, that is part of the power of the story of Easy Company is that these were not supermen. These were regular, and these were also not high class, you know, millionaires who were going and doing things. These were the salt of the earth. And afterwards, they went back to be that salt of the earth.
I think that's the point. I think the point of making it so simple, of Leap going back and driving mm-hmm. a cab, you know, Perk going back to be a mailman, right. All going into construction. It's to show the everyman. And of course, that thing of, well, what happened to this guy and this guy and this guy? Sure. But by the end of the war and by the end of the show, we are now in a situation where, you know, a lot of Easy Company have either been shipped back, who've been in or deceased and whatnot. And it's that same thing of how do you wrap
Kurt,
it up?
I completely understand that it's, you know, that the reasoning behind it, you know, I do find it funny that, you know, they find a way to bring Buck Compton back in there, you know, because I guess they needed a catcher for the baseball scene. And everyone knew he was an all-star catcher. So, you know, all right, if you're going to bring someone back, you bring back Compton. You know, that makes sense. You know, especially the way that he threw the grenade in the second episode, which apparently is true.
He had a heck of a throw on the
buck. He just threw it that way, and that's it. It makes sense. Again, that's my one slight pet peeve about it, but it's because I want to know more. That's the idea. It's not sure. Because I say, oh, it's crap because they did it this way. No, it's the exact opposite.
I also feel that the ending of that show is probably one of the most emotional endings of any show ever. And so I hear your point, but I also go, there's many that would say, don't change a lick of it, because it's just that. I mean, there's not a dry eye in the house 100%. Ever.
I am.
When that comes.
I agree. You know? Over the years, have you ever tried to get in touch with Liebgott's family?
It's not of a want of trying. Right at the beginning, when the show was airing, I was doing all that I could, and I was speaking to HBO, and we were trying to put out the feelers, and nothing was coming through. Over the years, and again, it's some of it you've got to be slightly careful of. Now we're somewhat known in the world of our industry, and people do come out and say, hey, I want to get in contact, and this is, you know, and they can. So you need to be careful. You need to figure out who's who. I have had over the years various members saying that they are members of the Liebgott family, and, you know, they've written to me or I've written back, but there's been nothing like really, you know, sitting down and breaking bread with the family, which I would love nothing more to do. But again, it really is down to, it's a funny old world. You got to make sure all the people are ticking the right boxes.
Sure.
You know,
for sure. There's no question about that. Okay. Is there any like anecdotes or stories of things that happened, you know, while you were filming, something on the set, something, I don't know, something maybe you ad-libbed during the production that, you know, that you think would be interesting to tell?
I mean, you know, there are so many stories that happened on that show that remain with us, not because they're particularly private, but because they just mean something to all of us. I think the scripts were pretty, pretty tight. However, what was wonderful was the writers did give us a little leeway if we felt that there was something that could be, you know, brought to light in an interesting way. And that happened often. You know, there were moments where people had to be curtailed a little bit, because you have to remember there's a timepiece too. It's not current day. So, you know, there's no ad-libbing of current measures. And so I think they had to be smart with that and be able to keep it to a point. And so, no, I mean, you know, the writers did most of it. I do remember when Liebgott goes up to take care of the commandant in the hills. Me and Ian, who plays Webster, sort of sat down for a long, long time and sort of played around with that scene a little bit and got the clearance from the writers. And we sort of came up with, between all of us, between the writers and the two of us, we kind of, you know, picked a little bits here and there and whatever. And our ad-libs were allowed and, and talking of the German on the back of the truck in nine, when Liebgott has to tell them to go back into the camp, I remember getting the dialogue a couple of weeks beforehand in German, and, you know, I don't speak German, so phonetically I had to learn it, and it just sounds like noise. So phonetically learning this dialogue, and the night before we shot, I got a frantic phone call from the dialogue coach, and the interpretation was wrong. And they're like, here it is here. So I had to read over the phone. I remember, you know, phonetically writing down, okay, this is what it is. And I had to shoot this the next day. And of course, you know, that was a tough one. But, you know, again, you step up to the plate.
Yeah. I spoke a few weeks ago with Tim Matthews. He told me that he was able to ad-lib one line. That he remembers where he tells Muck, you're an idiot. He said he ad-libbed that.
There you go. Nice.
He says he's sure of it. But okay, that's you know, I take his word for it. I trust him.
I think most of the guys like peppered in some things here and there, and again, you're dealing with actors who knew what they were doing, people who are professionals, and so anything that would work works.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And again, it's somewhat ironic because you were all young actors at the time.
Sure.
And so you would think logically that it would be harder to rein in younger actors than, more experienced actors. But hey, you guys all proved it that it doesn't always have to work that way.
There you go.
Great. Excellent. So, is there anything else you want to add?
No, that's I'm happy if you're happy, man. Yeah. Rob, I appreciate your time. I appreciate you putting it together, and I appreciate your passion for the show, man. It means a lot to all of us, and it helps, keep the men's legacy going, which is very important.
That's right, and now people can listen to it described in minute detail, 5-minute segments.
There we
There you go.
go. I love it. Well done. Keep up the good work. All
All
right.
right, Ross, thank you very much. This is great. I had a great time, and I appreciate your time that you're able to put aside to talk to me.
You got it, brother. Listen, be well. God bless. Talk soon.